The Big Picture, brought to you by Bible Society Australia, shining the light of God's Word into every corner of your world. And Sydney's Hope 103.2, there's always hope. The Big Picture, a Christian insight on the world of film, television and popular culture, with magazine editor Ben McKechin and scriptwriter Mark Hadley.
G'day, I'm Ben McKechin.
And I'm his choreographer, Mark Hadley. Welcome to episode 34 of The Big Picture for the week beginning October 19.
Are you afraid of heights? Well, you've come to the right place then, because we're going to take you higher with death-defying feet, The Walk.
And weird accents, snow, gripping crime yarns in Fargo Season 2.
Also, Johnny Depp goes gangster in Black Mass, as well as what Back to the Future 2 got right and wrong about October 21, 2015, which is this week.
I'm looking forward to this week for so many reasons.
Please outline all of them now.
Later in the show, Back to the Future is back.
I just heard that.
I know.
And many of other things, including Black Mass, The Walk, etc. We're going to get onto them very soon. Also, as you mentioned, Fargo, which I haven't got to watch yet, season two.
But it's brilliant. We're introducing a whole new segment this week too.
It's coming up much later in the show. But first, we're going to talk about a few other things that are happening this week around the place. Got a few movies, a few bits of news to get to. So firstly, movies also at cinemas this week is Bridge of Spies. Mark, have you seen this yet?
I'm seeing it tonight. Not meaning to rub it in or anything, but it's going to be fantastic.
But you just did by saying that. Yeah. Bridge of Spies reunites Saving Private Ryan's Steven Spielberg and Tom Hanks. It looks like this ripping old school spy flick that, I think this is the best way to put this, Mark, international critics have gone bananas. Bananas.
It's only because Tom Hanks is back.
That's the only reason?
I think they go bananas over that.
They're going bananas.
Okay, and actually also starting tonight on SBS, Dogs, Their Secret Lives.
Revealed.
Yes, you heard right. And no, it's not a series of Gary Larson comics from the 1980s. Dogs, Their Secret Lives combines science, members of the public, and some amazing dogs, no surprise there, to discover what man's best friend does when you're not there. They're not actually just lying around. Apparently they're doing stuff. Anyway, it's on Mondays from this week, 7:35 on SBS.
Great. Out on DVD and Blu-ray this week. There aren't that many choices around, Mark. One of the more interesting movies, I'm not sure how this is going to go, though, is the remake of Poltergeist. That very famous 80s creep fest about a little girl effectively gets sucked into a TV and there's evil spirits going on.
I freaked out.
Oh, you did at the remake?
No, not the news of it. I actually saw the film, and I'm not very good to sit next to in cinemas at the best of times, but so I do, I'm the jumper. I'm the guy who jumps.
All right, well, if you want to jump at something at home, Poltergeist is now available for you in your lounge room.
And also, tomorrow night, a documentary not to be missed, actually, Ka-Ching, Pokey Nation. I'm thrilled about watching this. I haven't seen a preview yet, but the concept is fantastic. You see, Australia has rapidly become the pokies capital of the world, with more machines and a higher spend than anywhere else. That's right, we are a pokey nation, and we're losing a staggering $12 billion a year, but everyone, players, industry and government, is hooked. The taxes that flow from it, the addiction itself. So this documentary looks into how the games are actually designed to hook a mind. It's not just a bunch of weak-minded people. These things are designed to actually get at you neurologically. So this is going to be a fascinating start. Have a look at it tomorrow night. It's going to be October 20, on 9:30 p.m. on the ABC.
In some entertainment news this week that hit a square between the eyes, Bridget Jones is back, Mark. Well, she will be back real soon. I know you've been desperate for this news.
This is not a remake.
But no, it's been almost a decade since she first showed up, but it's back. It's like another sequel. It's the third, the fourth. I can't even remember now. But Bridget Jones is coming back. Allegedly, the film's called Bridget Jones' Baby. Try to guess what that's going to be about. For Bridget Jones fans, Renee Zellweger's back. So is Colin Firth. But Hugh Grant will not be appearing as Bridget Jones' baby, or at least in Bridget Jones' Baby.
Look at my shock. No Hugh Grant.
No Hugh Grant.
Oh, I don't know who's like the best character.
Chin up, Mark.
Okay. And as if world domination in the gaming arena was not enough.
It's not enough.
It's not. Rovio Entertainment, the developers of Angry Birds, yes, you might as well just hear Game Crack. you know, as far as as far as portable devices are concerned. Rovio has teamed up with Columbia to make, yes, you guessed it, the Angry Birds movie. Now, some people might have actually heard the rumor of this terrifying production, but the trailer has just been recently released, so you can just Google it and check it out and basically see that a thin game plot has become an even thinner story plot. So, you know, go have a look. It's, at this point, it looks like it's coming out in May 2016.
Sure. That's this week. Moving on.
Well, we can't help it. We no sooner come up with a winning segment than we're doing our best to stretch its definition.
Oh, we just can't help that.
What your kids are watching is usually that time of the show when we talk in detail about the sorts of titles that particularly target the younger members of your family. However, this week, we feel certain new Hollywood release The Walk is certain to attract the attention of your older children. So, in the aptly renamed What Your Progeny Are Watching...
Sorry, What Your Progeny Are Watching?
You know, listen, get a thesaurus, okay? That's all I can say.
Wow, okay, yes.
This is why,
catchy.
This is why I'm the writer. This week, we take a look at a true story turned tall tale about a French high wire artist, Philippe Petit, and his determination to walk between the twin towers of the World Trade Center. The Walk, a one-way, no-stops lesson in following your dreams.
People ask me, why do you risk death? For me, this is life.
Welcome to New York. Anything to declare?
I'm going to hang a high wire between the two towers of the World Trade Center and walk on it.
Good luck.
No matter where I was going or what I was doing, I was always searching, looking for the perfect place to hang my wire.
I need you to help me pull this off.
I got just the guys. Now it starts.
Oh, now it starts, Mark.
This is the only thing.
Outrageous French accent.
I don't know. Does everybody's accent sound bad in the mouth of an American? I don't know. I feel like the world is a cartoon. Look, this... The Walk is based on an incredible production, Man on Wire, a documentary. It was a fantastic documentary.
It was. It was only out in 2008.
So, Ben, do we need a film?
I didn't think so. No. And after seeing The Walk, I'm still not convinced. I like the movie enough. I'd say the main reason it was made into a feature film that Joseph Gordon-Levitt is starring in as this Frenchman, Philippe, the main reason it was made is because not... the same numbers of audience don't go to documentaries as they do to feature films. It'll get a wider release around the world as a feature film. And also it can be much more trumpeted as what this film is trumpeting itself as, which is this triumph of artistic endeavor and the human spirit and following your dreams and living out your passions. That comes through a lot more strongly, I think, in this film than it did in the documentary.
Yeah, I'm going to just overlook the fact that you slighted the documentary viewing audience of the world.
I wasn't slighting the audience, I'm slighting the size of it in relation to the cinema audience.
We're all tiny.
Thank you.
Okay. But how does it work as a film? Okay. I mean, does Joseph Gordon-Levitt actually handle a decent French accent? Or
See, I thought it was all right. I think it was meant to be deliberately over the top, and I don't think it's parroting French accents as much as it might sound from that clip and when you see the film. Because the film is deliberately heightened, it's played a lot more for...
See what you did
Thank
there.
You, see what I did? So as opposed to the documentary, which really does ground you more in the real-life situation of this, this film does fictionalize somewhat what was going on, try to make it... It effectively shapes itself as a crime caper. Where the longer the film goes along, it reworks itself as a crime caper where Philippe is trying to work out how am I going to get to the top of the newly erected Twin Towers in the 70s to do this walk so I can do this thing and show the world my artistic triumph. And the film, yeah, because it skews towards the crime caper, I think you can forgive some of the bigger elements of the film, including Joseph Gordon-Levitt's French accent.
How about the vertigo side of it? I mean, this is all very much about standing on a wire at the top of the world. So
yeah, it's in IMAX in 3D, and if you are not into the film along the way, which I was a little bit like drifting off at some points in this film. You stick around for the end because it's worth the last 45, 50 minutes of this high wire walk where if you do suffer from vertigo or fear of heights, you will freak out
at the
vision that you're seeing.
They sustain that for 45 minutes.
They do, which is what Philippe was out on that wire for that longer time. So they just get their money's worth in this movie and put you on that wire for that period of time. It's one of the high points, Mark, of The Walk.
Thank you. So is Philippe the sort of hero you'd like to have around? Or
no.
Is he the sort of guy you'd be going, would you get down off the shelf? What are you doing up there?
No. Out of all the heroes you want in human history, I don't think Philippe is the one. I thought it came through very strongly in the documentary, not as much in this movie, how selfish this man was. I don't think I'm making this up. I don't think I've misread his character. He was a very selfish guy, driven by his own dreams, so much so that, and you do get this in the film as well, his friends were like going at him about, you're doing this, is all about you, you don't appreciate us, we're trying to help you out in this. And it was all just, I'm following my passion, I'm following my dream. He didn't care about anybody else. And yeah, it does come through more strongly in the documentary. It is there in the movie, but you also get this interplay between him wanting to realize his dream, that's being celebrated by the movie, at the same time as, you're a really selfish individual, my man. So as a hero, I found him very difficult to embrace and want to get behind.
This is actually very much real life. In terms of the documentary, he doesn't come off well at all, like in some respects, or at least you've really got to be French to appreciate what he's doing.
I don't know. And I'm sure not all French people are like this guy. So yeah, one of the big issues I've got with the film is a difficult hero to embrace.
Okay, well, speaking of difficult things to embrace, setting a story around the Twin Towers. Now, the Twin Towers has just become emblematic of tragedy. And anytime you see those pictures, it's almost like you're supposed to be feeling horror and terror about what went on. How do they cope with that in a film?
Well, the film, it becomes almost a celebration of the Twin Towers in the end. I didn't get this as strongly when I came out of the film, but I've talked to other people since then, and an American guy particularly, who was very struck by what seems like a tribute to the Twin Towers. There's something about the combination of what Philippe's trying to do by his artistic endeavor to walk between the Twin Towers that somehow encapsulates a spirit or some kind of fond, positive memory, even though he's breaking the law while he's doing this thing, some positive memory of the Twin Towers, which, you know, have forever been destroyed, for want of a better word, by 9/11. So the walk does become some sort of strange tribute to the World Trade Center that I think will affect people quite strongly, definitely more than what I was affected by the film. But I think if you recognize how powerfully these are characters in this film, I think it will change the way we think, possibly the world thinks, about the World Trade Center.
Wow, that's amazing. Okay, well, listen, The Walk is directed by Robert Zemeckis and stars Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Charlotte Le Bon, Ben Kingsley, and James Badgerdale. It's rated PG for mild themes and coarse language, and whoa for filmgoers who suffer vertigo.
Still to come on the show, we're going to play some music to Walk High by, and we're also going to get to the return of Fargo. Stick around.
Mark and Ben on The Big Picture, a popular look. No, sorry.
It is, though.
It is a popular look at Christian.
At least with us.
It's a Christian look anyway, in popular culture.
On to our soundtrack choice for this week. We just discussed the new film, The Walk. One of the things I was most struck by in that film is the music, and here is one of the songs from that film. Ah, oh, Mark, of course you recognise that song.
I love that sort of swing and funk. It's
Sly
great.
And the Family Stone, Want to Take You Higher. One of the things I did love about The Walk, very much so, was the awesome soundtrack. A little bit like Legend, that's also around at cinemas at the moment. They have this incredible, funktastic, soul-rific, Motown-inspired soundtracks that just go a little bit bonkers when it comes to the funk. Hence why we're playing Sly and the Family Stone. And Mark, we should just stop talking about it and play some more. Oh, Mark, that was so fantastic. It was almost ridiculous. Sly the Family Stone, I Want to Take You Higher. Now, onto something I'm also a little bit pumped about, Mark. A little bit. You may be able to hear that in my voice.
More than a little bit.
Fargo is one of those Hollywood films that perpetuates the myth of Tinseltown, where this low-budget offering from the Coen brothers that netted two Academy Awards became a massive commercial success. It then had a spin-off television series, which... I'm sure I'm not alone by thinking that was weird. Like, that was so unexpected.
Everyone was like,
Of any kind of spin-off from a movie, I didn't think Fargo was going to come out of the can, but it did. And it went along a similar path of critical acclaim, particularly. And now we're at season two, and this is hence why I'm excited, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners are, and why we're featuring Fargo season two in Now Showing this week. It's right on our doorstep. Fargo season two, you can almost taste it. It's releasing through SBS and premiering in Australia this Wednesday. And once again, we look under Minnesota's pristine snow to discover the dark heart of humanity.
Well, this is a deal.
Hank's thinking botched robbery.
Oh, sure. That's how it starts, with something small, like a break-in at the Watergate Hotel. But this thing's only getting bigger.
G-53.
Judge, huh?
So less likely a robbery got bad, more likely a judge-specific beef.
Mm-hmm. Judgment.
Which brings us to who shot her and where'd he go?
Hun, don't.
There's a man in the...
Definitely a series to watch, don't you know?
Yeah.
I've got to say, look, I understand your excitement about Fargo because it's one of those things that crept up on us year before last and was just brilliant. And now it's back and you're sort of going, whoa, it's like welcoming friends home to the TV set. It's like one of the reasons why TV is just really, really good, because you can take a storyline that you just couldn't encapsulate in one film and spread over week after week of great excitement. And that's pretty much what they're doing. Okay, so the success of this series, you know, Joel and Ethan Coen are back as the executive producers. Noah Hawley's the writer-director.
Who's the guy who did the first series,
didn't he? First series. So it's the original team bringing back the second series, which is not a given in Tinseltown. This is actually pretty good news. And this time around, we've got a brand new all-star cast who'll take us back to the tumultuous late 1970s for a fresh mystery imbued with Fargo's trademark dark intrigue and sort of black comedy. Zany characters, and you'll be speaking Minnesota nice in no time, don't you know?
Oh,
once you get through
this.
You
just saying that around the house now?
Yeah, now, all my children just speak Minnesota.
But they're not watching Fargo, are they?
They're not. Because my wife and I have been sitting up watching it. I know you the audience, this is how desperate Ben is. He's sending me constant emails saying, can you share the links? Can you share links?
I want to watch the preview episodes, Mark.
I know. So it's well worth the wait.
It is? Why so?
Because I'm going to make you wait.
But once I get past the wait, why is it worth watching? And how does it stand up so well against the first season?
Well, firstly, for those people who are familiar with the first series, there's actually a kind of a link. There was this event that was constantly talked about in the first series of Fargo. People keep referring back to, you know, it reminds me of Sioux Falls and that terrible time at Sioux Falls and what happened at Sioux Falls. And that just gets dotted all the way through the series. Well, now we're going back and we're looking at Sheriff Hank Larson, who's being played by legendary Ted Danson.
Ted Danson of Cheers and Three Men and a Baby fame.
With Lou Solverson, who's this young state trooper. Now, he's played by Patrick Wilson, and Solverson makes an appearance in the first series as the dad of the main character, the detective. And now it's back into his history in the 70s, and we're all arriving at Sioux Falls to see what happened at Sioux Falls, you know, a couple of decades earlier. So it's brilliant. It's self-contained. In fact, every episode is self-contained. You can watch it and crash into the middle of the series and enjoy it. You can watch season two having not seen season one. In fact, you can watch season two and be inspired to go watch season one, so you don't feel like you're trapped. But it's really great story. It's darkly comic. It's just as much mystery, and it's just as much factor, you know, when you watch what happens to sort of the villainous characters.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that. You've just mentioned dark a few times. It is funny, and we're also guys who are singing the praises of the first TV show. As you just mentioned, I haven't yet seen any of this second season. But the dark side, there's a lot of dark black undercurrent going on in Fargo, and it sounds like in season two. What's it telling us about us, do you think, Fargo? Has it got a bigger message to share with us, or is it just a cracking yarn with some really dark comedy and some, and particularly hard-hitting violence as well?
Well, I really should say, yeah, you've brought up a good point. Fargo, both the film, the first series, and indeed the second series, has some moments that are decidedly violent and brutal, but they're in a kind of a almost commonplace brutality that hints at something else. It's like criminals are going about their daily lives. Oh, well, I guess it's time to push another body through the meat grinder sort of thing. Now, you don't see things so far as that would be terribly, terribly disturbing. But at the same time, you do get at that commonplace evil of humanity. And one of the great things about Fargo, if I can use that sort of descriptor, is that it doesn't limit the truly terrible things to those people who are the truly bad guys. Okay, so there are evil characters in the series, but you find quite normal people are capable of quite terrible things.
Mm, that was one of the amazing, compelling things about the first season.
And this is one of the things I really like about it from a Christian point of view, because sin is not something that is, in fact, actually just particular to people who are bad.
It's not just reserved for this one group of people.
Yeah, we might think, too, by the way, that we look at some of the things on the international news, crazy stories coming out of the Midwest, or for that matter, things that are happening in the Middle East. And we might say, well, that's just so far away from my world. But the Bible wants to say that we are so infected by sin that it is only opportunity that we really lack. And this is a good reminder. When you see people who are having quite normal lives, but they have themselves threatened, you know, with something that they hold dear, one of their personal idols, whether it be success or whether it be their standing in the community or their hopes for the future, sin runs right in there, takes advantage of the opportunity and turns them into the worst possible version of themselves. So, I mean, in the same sense, what is funny too is just how stupid we are that we think we can get away with sin. I mean, this is the thing that thrills me about this series, that the characters are funny because they're dumb. And I guess from a certain perspective, from the perspective of eternity, people looking down on us, or God for that matter, looking at what we're doing in our world, might just be laughing. You know, I just the thought that we would think we could get away with this, that we could just be this way and there would be no consequence. And so I sort of figure when you're laughing, you're kind of also laughing at yourself. Anyone who stands in rebellion against God has got to remember that there's a comeuppance, and Fargo is good at telling us that.
If I wasn't excited about Fargo Season 2, Mark, I am now. Series 2 of Fargo is 10 episodes long. It kicks off on Wednesday, October 21 at 8:30 p.m. It's got a double episode happening on SBS. It's rated M for Major Mob Syndicates, don't you know? I can't do that as well as you. So be prepared for grisly discoveries, you betcha. That's not even close.
Not even close. Well, listen, you're probably wondering where you can find out more of this scintillating commentary and accents that we're putting on today. You've been experiencing this for the past half hour or so, or possibly you just want to sue us. And if that's the case, the best way to find out if it's the former, finding more, go to thebigpicturewebsite.com. If it's the latter, as in the suing, I'm sorry, we have no idea what you're talking about. But we welcome all sorts of input over at the Big Picture Facebook page. Even a like would be appreciated if you can just move your mouse that far to click. And if you're technically minded, you can send us a recording of your own cultural insight via thebigpicture@gmail.com. And don't forget, the whole shebang goes live on Hope 103.2 FM from November 8 at 8 p.m. Set your sundial.
This is Ben and Mark on The Big Picture. Still to come on the show, just, oh man, we're so close to learning what Back to the Future got right and wrong. Back to the Future 2 got right and wrong about October 21.
I love these moments. Anyway,
and we're also going to see Johnny Depp going gangster.
Ben and Mark on The Big Picture. October 21st, 2015 is a red letter date in the history of the world. It's happening this week, and we already know that Marty McFly and Doc Brown are going to turn up in a flying time machine in the town of Hill Valley, America. We know this because in 1989, Back to the Future 2 revealed this pivotal event. That's right, those were the numbers spinning up on the dial. To celebrate finally arriving in the future, editor of Real Gospel and host of Hope Nights, Sam Robinson, joined Ben this week for a flux-capacitated press record session about whether we are living in the Back to the Future 2 reality we expected.
Sam, I'm going to make a public confession.
Yes.
Like most of us know, I'm a massive fan of Back to the Future. That's just a fact. But, and here's the confession, it's to my shame that there are really big dates that are involved in the Back to the Future trilogy when Marty McFly heads back to the past or into the future, wherever it might be, big dates that I just don't remember, including Wednesday, October 21, 2015. Now, you had to remind me that in Back to the Future 2, that is the exact day that Marty McFly and Doc go into the future. Thank you for reminding me, my friend, because I have been shamed out by it.
That's okay. I would have forgotten as well if I didn't see a news article, but as well an ad for Pepsi in a catalogue for a supermarket that advertises, obviously a promotion, but they got the time wrong. I think they said it was 8:29 in the night, but it's actually 4:29, I think, the time they arrive.
You are exactly right. And I take it, like me, you went off and rewatched Back to the Future 2?
I did.
So we can celebrate this week where we're in the future, Sam.
Yes, we need to have a little bit of a welcome party, I think, for Doc.
Welcome aboard party to the future. Mate, what did you think of the future that apparently we should be living in right now?
I've got to say, for one, the style of the future I love because it is so 80s. It's kind of a glamorized 80s with kind of a robotic hue to it.
Very, very true, which is kind of like today, but not quite. As in, a lot of hipster fashion is really influenced by the 80s, but I wouldn't say it's like the neon leggings aerobics meets robot that was going on in Back to the Future 2.
Yeah, that's right. I think they got some good things right. They got like a Skype video call thing. They did that well. The TV screens are a bit strange.
But they are massive, and they also play multiple channels at once.
That's true, yes.
Which is pretty darn impressive. There's also stuff in the future like old architecture still remains. I was impressed with that.
Yes, but what they did miss, I think, well, obviously the flying cars. We don't have flying cars yet. I mean, we've got a few days until the 21st.
That's exactly right. Who knows what they'll release in the next couple of days?
It'll be a surprise on the 21st.
I heard talk that even Nike might have been releasing those power lace-up shoes that Marty McFly wears. And so, yeah, Nike's got a couple of days to knock those things together. And no hoverboard.
No hoverboard. Well, I think that there was one that was made, but not very well. And I think it's not official hoverboard standard.
Robert Zemeckis, the director of the Back to the Future movies, he reckons that they got the future about 50% right. He didn't go into details on what that exactly was. I'm presuming what he's talking about, the 50% they did get right, was some of those things that we just listed off. And then there's other stuff like plastic surgery and thumbprint IDs into a house. But the 50% they didn't get right is probably this cooler stuff that everybody remembers from Back to the Future 2 and wanted. The power lace-up shoes, which producer Steven Spielberg said is the one invention he wanted in the future. So yeah. Steven Spielberg's got a couple of days and that might come true. So no power lace-ups, no hoverboard, no flying cars, and also no massive hologram promoting Jaws 19.
That's right. And no Jaws 19.
Which may or may not be a bad thing, Sam.
That's right.
Now, looking forward further into the future, would you like to see more Back to the Future movies? You're a massive fan like I am.
No, I think they need to leave it in the past. I think especially because this is kind of one of those nostalgic summer blockbuster trilogies that was just fine. Zemeckis did a great job. It belongs in the 80s. Let's leave it there. That's my vote.
I can't help but agree.
It belongs in the 80s. Let's just leave it there.
That's great. Well, listen, let's talk about something that was, you know, sort of similar decade, but actually right here and now. Before he fought with the Australian government about dog smuggling charges, Johnny Depp got all gangster for based on a true story crime flick, Black Mass. Now, Depp plays Whitey Bulger, a South Boston crime boss who had an unusual working relationship with the FBI in the 1970s. Ben checked out Depp's underbelly and was reminded of why the Bible is such a big supporter of running in the opposite direction when evil shows up.
What's that?
In the beginning, Jim was a small-town player.
He's a very smart, disciplined man.
Take your shot.
Enough.
But make it your best, because I get up, I eat you. I'm at
the
table,
you can come and lay your. And the next thing you know, he's a damn kingpin. I'm at the shoulder, you know why? Because the FBI let it happen.
I grew up with Jimmy and his brother Billy, the senator. And that is a bond that doesn't get broken.
Your brother is wading into some very dark waters. Jimmy's business is Jimmy's business. We all need friends. Even Jimmy.
Black Mass is at cinemas at the moment, Mark. You're right, it does star Johnny Depp as this South Boston figure, Whitey Bulger. And also this amazing cast, one of these movies that as soon as you see the poster, they almost can't fit all the names on the poster, like Everest recently, that really struggled to fit everybody's name on. So you've got Australian actor Joel Edgerton, who's been turning up in all kinds of stuff. Benedict Cumberbatch, the Cumberbatch, of course, is in this.
The Batch.
Jesse Plemons, who's also in Fargo Season 2 at the moment. Kevin Bacon shows up. He's great as this FBI guy, this FBI boss who gets really hardline at a few points. The film is a drama about about Whitey Bulger. And as you said in the intro, his unusual working relationship with the FBI, which is a euphemism, really, for saying that Whitey Bulger and his old childhood friend, John Connolly, who's played by Joel Edgerton, who grows up to be an FBI agent. And so they can both help each other out. John Connolly goes to Whitey Bulger in South Boston and says, if you give me information about the mafia, that you're effectively your rival gang for turf wars, I will leave you alone and you can do whatever you want to do, and I will bring in the heads of mafia. So it works out for everybody.
Hey, everybody's happy.
And
except the public.
That's right. And some members of the FBI who actually have some integrity. So that's what Black Mass. That's what Black Mass is. It's up on screens at the same sort of time as Legend. That's the Tom Hardy film where he's starring as both the Cray brothers, the notorious London gangsters. So there's two gangster films at the moment. Legend remains the stronger choice. Incredibly, given Johnny Depp is playing a gangster and that cast and like the whole storyline sounds amazing, similar to the Krays and putting them up on screen. But in contrast to Legend, which had a real there's a lot of enthusiasm and passion and a real kind of pulse about that film. It was very gripping. Black Mass, not so much. It seems to think that its characters and the situations are enough to drive a storyline that's going to keep you intrigued, keep you drawn in all the way along. And that it didn't grip me as much as that.
What a pity, because in a sentence, or a couple of sentences, the plot you just gave then would have me running off to buy a movie ticket.
Yeah, like, it's one of those really movies. Good. It's not boring by any means. And the performances are incredible. But even let's go to Johnny Depp in this central role as Whitey Bulger. And you get very distracted by the fact that he's got thinning hair and he's got this prosthetics on. The makeup work is good on him, but you get a little bit distracted by that. But he hasn't...
What was that American sort of crime flick just a couple of years ago? Got a great mention. And it was all about the prosthetics. It was all about the hair, but the storyline fell over.
That escapes me entirely. Great. We should have done our research beforehand.
We should have talked about that.
But this movie doesn't entirely fall over. But Johnny Depp doesn't quite get into this character so deeply that you forget it's Johnny Depp. And also, you're just waiting for the moment where this guy, who's clearly nuts and will do whatever, he's a very ruthless gangster guy who just wants to be a crime kingpin. You keep waiting for this minute where he's going to explode. Or you get those scenes around the table where he's saying something and it's really quite passive and nice. And you're just waiting for the bit where he just goes off, like flies off the handle and punches someone in the face, and
it starts to become predictable.
It does, and like I felt like in myself, I was thinking, oh, I shouldn't really want for this. I shouldn't want him to keep exploding on screen. But I kept waiting for the moment. It turns up every now and again. But the character himself isn't as enthralling as what you might have expected. And I think there's a lot more momentum going on in Legend, and there's a lot more charisma demonstrated by Tom Hardy as the Cray brother in that film, in contrast with Black Mass.
So yeah, I find it really hard to choose between Tom Hardy actually as to who gave the better performance in that particular film. But what about the whole idea of evil? I mean, both films deal with evil. What does Black Mass have to say about the idea of working with evil?
That's one of the more interesting parts of the film. You get to see this character of John Connolly, Joel Edgerton's character, who at the outset you think he is doing this for noble reasons, and even he tells himself that too, that if it's what he's doing, if he does something bad but it ends in something good, then that's fine. So working with Whitey Bulger and overlooking the crime that this man is overseeing in South Boston, that's fine if you want to bring down this other group of who they all determine to be worse people by their own judgment. They've decided this group is worse than this guy, so let's go and get them. So what it then demonstrates as the movie goes along, and this is basically the through line of the film, and where it gets a little bit confusing in Black Mass about exactly whose movie is this that we're watching. It's not just the Whitey Bulger story. It's John Connolly, and watching his descent into or towards evil, that you're trying to work with something. You're effectively trying to control evil if you can. You're trying to make it work for the good. And what Black Mass demonstrates is, well, at least in this case, so difficult to do that, and to the point where it ends up corrupting your own soul, your own person, as a result of being of trying to work hand in hand with evil.
I love the way that you're actually starting to talk about it personally. Did you feel that way, that it was a real moral lesson at the end, that personally speaking, we can't tolerate evil? I mean, are there, or did it say that, maybe certain people can't tolerate evil?
Yeah, I don't think the movie's necessarily trying to leave you with that message, as in walk away and think no one should ever do this. It doesn't force that on you, but that's definitely a strong reading of the film. And it's very clear from what John Connolly does with Whitey Bulger's, what they do, that you, like this, if you enter a situation like this, to think you could control it and work so closely with evil, you can't do it. And so it was a good reminder to me and a good challenge to me personally, thinking about the Bible often talks at different points about fleeing from evil. It says that in 1 Corinthians and talks about in the letter of James about submitting your life to God, giving your life over to God, and the devil will resist you. Evil will kind of flee away from you. So that's more the idea of don't go and embrace evil. Don't go and embrace the bad things of the world, but instead try to get as far away as you can. And if you go towards God, then actually those evil things will race away from you. What Black Mass reminds me is I find that really difficult to do. I don't know about everybody else out there, but I find that really difficult to do, where you often, like John Connolly in Black Mass, try to get as close as you can. Like, how close can I get to this bad, evil thing without actually doing it, without doing it as much, or as much as that other guy? And Black Mass, one of the strongest parts of this film, is a cautionary tale about how close can you get. And the moral of the story is you can't.
Yeah, there's like, no close.
There's no safe distance apart from going in the opposite direction. And Black Mass hits home hard that message.
Well, Black Mass stars Johnny Depp, Joel Edgerton, Benedict Cumberbatch,
The Cumberbatch!
And Fargo's Season 2's Jesse Plemons. It's now showing at cinemas everywhere and is accurately rated MA15+ for strong violence and coarse language, as gangsters will do.
Uh-huh, they sure do. Coming up on the show, we've got a very cool underdog classic, and then Mark unveils the top 5 crash and burn moments.
And a new segment coming up too. Mark and Ben with The Big Picture, a Christian insight into popular culture. Well, on last week's show, find it at thebigpicturewebsite.com, we introduced you to our newest segment, The Vault. Led by our movie mates over at Insights Magazine and website, The Vault takes the hassle out of picking a classic or notable movie. How often have you stood there and just gone, what will we watch tonight? Well, we pick up a type of movie and ask the Insights team to scour the deep, vast vault of movie history. They come back covered in cobwebs, but with a top pick, so you don't have to do anything but thank them later on. This week, Toya Gaddis from Insights comes back with a cool choice for those times when you're looking for an underdog story to cheer for.
Now, Toya, we sent you away down deep, dark into the archives that are the Big Picture vault, and we gave you a challenge. We wanted you to dig something up out of the crate that was a movie about people exceeding expectations, you know, underdogs rising up, people beating the odds. Now, you came out with a couple of selections, didn't you?
Yes, I did. A few struck me when you gave me that assignment. Forrest Gump, Spirited Away, Fly Away Home, and Cool Runnings.
That's a pretty diverse grab bag of movies.
Yeah, definitely diverse. But when you mentioned that classic underdog story, those are the ones that really hit home, especially Fly Away Home. Shout out to Dad. Him and I used to watch that all the time.
That was big with you and your dad. Okay, so yes, that gets your dad vote. But what did you settle on for The Vault this week?
I settled on for The Vault with Cool Runnings.
Cool Runnings. Okay, for any of us who haven't seen Cool Runnings, what is Cool Runnings?
Cool Runnings is based on the true story of the Jamaican bobsled team that competed in the 1988 Winter Olympics in Canada.
It is amazing that that is a true story.
I know. You wouldn't believe it. But
so yeah, amazing, you have to make a movie about it.
Exactly right. And Walt Disney did a really good job too.
And that movie came out, I think, about 5 years later in 1993. So that's more than 20 years ago now. You've rewatched this again. How do you think it stands up?
I think it still stands up. I mean, when I chose Cool Runnings, I hadn't seen it in a while, but it still really popped into my mind. As soon as you said that underdog film, triumph over adversity, that's the first thing I kind of thought of. Oh, Cool Runnings. And after watching it again, it still stays there in the front of my mind.
Yeah, it's the kind of movie that shows up often on TV, or like usually once a year. It's the kind of movie that people saw it back in the 90s. They took it to their heart. It was a massive movie at the time, wasn't it? And it does continue to endure. Do you think it's just the notable subject matter? It does sound so incredible you couldn't make it up. Do you think that's the only reason it's so popular as an underdog story?
In a way, yes. It's that true story that you just couldn't possibly make up. You're always kind of like, wow, I can't believe this happens. Like, I just can't believe this is actually legitimately real. But I think that Disney as well, they added a few different kind of dimensions to the film. It wasn't just a film about the 4-person Jamaican bobsled team going to Canada. There are a lot of different layers in the film, and I think those layers is what made you feel all warm and fuzzy inside when watching it.
Out of all that, Toya, as you think about Cool Runnings, this great vault selection for this week, really good choice, what do you take away from it?
I think what you can take away from Cool Runnings is to believe in yourself and believe in your goals, regardless of what other people are saying, regardless of the obstacles that you have to overcome. And I think that also can then relate as to a Christian watching that film, you know, always believe and trust in the fact that God has a path for you. Things aren't always going to work out. I mean, that's exactly what Cool Runnings is about. Things don't go to plan. Things don't happen the way you planned them to happen. But once you sit back and you trust that God has a path for you, you can achieve anything, really. And in the end, sometimes the new path that you've taken is even better than what you had originally planned for yourself.
Thank you, Toya, for rummaging through the vault and coming up with Cool Runnings. Now, if you want some more of Toya's work and the rest of the team at Insights, they've got loads of reviews over on their site. Go to insights.uca.org.au. That is correct, insights.uca.org.au, and you will find way more reviews from Toya and the other Insights reviewers over there. Those guys know what they're on about.
Actually, while we're talking about things worth checking out this week, you should actually have a look at Eternity's October edition. Eternity, the Christian newspaper, has a variety of articles about how we can welcome the 12,000 Syrian refugees arriving on our shores over the next 6 months, which I think is immensely practical, because as Christians, we can't just watch this sort of event take place. So they've spoken to Jared McKenna in Western Australia, who's been living with the refugee families in their home for several years now, about what it's like to open your home to refugees, while other articles look at the response of Bible societies around the world to the humanitarian crisis, which is unfolding across Europe, where hundreds of thousands of refugees from Syria, Iraq, and places in Northern Africa are fleeing en masse. So the October edition of Eternity Newspaper for more details, out in a church near you. This week in our top five, we're going to take a lead from Toya's choice from The Vault. Well, nearly a lead. Cool Runnings involves lots of catastrophic crashes, and that got us thinking about spectacular collisions, crunches and collapses in movies. Not all of them involve actual crashes, some are far more spectacular than that. So without further ado, I present to you my top five crash and burn movie moments.
Five.
I think it only appropriate that we begin with the film Crash and Burn, which came out in...
I see what you did there.
Yes, thank you. Which came out in 2008. Now, it is worth mentioning because it was a movie so bad, it couldn't even raise interest in its title. It crashed, burned, and went straight to DVD. It's a stand-in for every film that ever thought a title would be enough to sell tickets. Yes, Snakes on a Plane, I'm looking at you. Crash and Burn is currently rated 45,074 on IMDb's movie rating scale.
I presume there's some underneath that.
And has, well, only a few. And has no rating on Rotten Tomatoes or Metacritic because no one could be bothered to write about it. So there you go. Not to be mistaken for the 1990 science fiction called Crash and Burn, which is only rated 38,000. If there's one thing to learn from these productions, it's avoid Crash and Burn as a title. It's too much like a prophecy.
Four.
My next Crash and Burn film is kind of like a stand-in for almost every film that has attempted to thrill us by crashing and burning big things.
I love that kind of movie.
Well, Deep Impact, that wasn't so bad. Independence Day, I personally liked. Meteor, Godzilla, well, I was a little jaded by then. But 2012, okay, was quite possibly the worst, in fact, and therefore occupies the
best. I love
that
movie. Oh, come on, Mark.
It has pride of place because it's so bad, it makes the end
so
of the
bad.
World.
It's great.
It makes the end of the world look like a ho-hum affair. 2012, probably the most interesting thing to say about that film is that it came out in 2009. Why the marketers didn't think that one through, I'm not sure. Let's move on to number three. Now, we'd mentioned that there would be at least one spectacular crash itself in the film, so I'm going to nominate at number three in my Crash and Burn moments, Alive. The 1993 Crash and Burn, when the Uruguayan rugby team sprained
its... Easy how sensitively you speak about this, Mark.
This is a true story.
I know. Hence the sensitivity.
So watch how I segue into a much more concerned tone.
Please.
Okay. We're talking about the Uruguayan rugby team stranded in the snow-swept Andes, who are forced to use desperate measures to survive after a plane crash. And so it's, in fact, actually an incredible film. These desperate measures involve eating each other. Yes, this is not so much Crash and Burn as Crash and Cook.
Sensitive.
I know. I was handling it well, and now I'll move on. Making it my crash and burn film with the greatest ew factor. Now let's move to number two.
Two.
Crash and burn moments in film. The most prolonged crash and burn has to be Crash from 2004. And I think this stands in for all those incredible films where personalities come crashing down stage by stage, where you see the interaction of multiple characters. Crash was one of the first films to take disparate storylines that seem completely unrelated, miniature stories, and then link them together in an almighty personal crash. Traffic did the same sort of thing. Bonfire of the Vanities was somewhere along the line. Of course, you also see great crash, emotional crash moments in things like Wall Street, for example, where the personality crashes and burns. Not Wall Street 2, Money Never Sleeps. That crashed that and just, burned.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. That's, yes.
One.
Mate, yeah. What can be at number one on crashing and burning in
crashing
cinema
and burning
history?
In cinema. There are moments in movies where crashing and burning a character can actually be not so tragic as hilarious. Take John Cusack in Better Off Dead, for example. My favourite scene in that moment is, man, that's a real shame when folks throw away a perfectly good white boy. You know, when he's tried to commit suicide and jumped into a dump truck. Anyway,
sensitivity.
There
but
you
it
go.
Is a comedy.
But coming in at number one is Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
That's really not surprising. Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
It's not because the film crashes and burns.
Heck
the film
no.
is an incredible success because of the crashing and burning of Principal Rooney.
Oh.
Principal Rooney is this character for whom Ferris Bueller just manages to hoodwink again and again and again to the complete and total destruction of his character and job by the end of it. And you might remember this if you've seen this film. There's this wonderful moment in which he's at the end, his clothes have been torn up, he's on the school bus because his car is destroyed, he's going home, and the dweebiest girl in the school offers him a gummy bear. They're nice and warm. And he looks up and there's this graffiti that just insults him as an individual, and that sums the film. So I figure if we're going to have a great crash and burn moment in cinematic history, it has to be what happens to Principal Rooney.
Ed Rooney.
Ed, this is George Peterson.
How are you today, sir?
Well, we've had a bit of bad luck this morning, as you may have heard.
Yeah, I heard, and well, I'm all broken up. Boy, what a blow.
Yeah. Well, it's been a tough morning, and we've got a lot of family business to take care of, so if you wouldn't mind excusing Sloan, I'd appreciate it.
Sure. Yeah, I'd be happy to. Yeah, you just produce a corpse, and I'll release Sloan. I want to see this dead grandmother firsthand.
Dad.
It's all right, Grace. It's Ferris Bueller, a little twerp. I'm going to set a trap and let him fall right into it.
Ed, I'm sorry. Did you say you wanted to see a body?
Yeah, that's right. Just roll her old bones on over here, and I'll dig up your daughter. You know that school policy.
Oh?
Was this your mother?
No, my wife's mother.
Ed Rooney's office.
Hi, this is Ferris Bueller. Can I speak to Mr. Rooney, please? Thank you.
Crash. And burn.
And burn. Forgot how funny that is.
I know, it's an hilarious. And that's not the best moment to see. Look, if you haven't seen Ferris Bueller's Day Off, you're missing cinematic history. Go grab a copy somewhere. These days, you're probably just going to download it.
Just
away.
Watch it.
Watch it. Coming up, we've got to look forward to next week's show because coming up next week's show.
So stunned by crashing and burning.
I
won't even make jokes about crashing and burning.
I'm going to tell you all about Bridge of Spies, which is opening next week. I have seen it. It's fantastic. We're really going to have great fun with it. So you tune in for Bridge of Spies. We'll give you the best of Tom Hanks.
That's coming on the podcast next week. Also, The Dressmaker, this new Australian film starring Kate Winslet.
And what are the kids watching? Well, the kids are watching Paranormal Activity, but they're watching it in 3D, so if they weren't freaked out enough by sleepless nights, they're going to be even worse next week.
I've definitely been Ben McKechnie throughout this episode, Mark.
And I'll remain Mark Hadley. See you next week.
The Big Picture is a Bible Society Australia production and part of Hope 103.2's family of podcasts and vodcasts.